I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Tax day is tomorrow. Big tax votes are scheduled in Congress this week. Coincidence? We don't think so. President Obama's plan to raise tax rates for millionaires comes up in the Senate today. And Republicans in the House will vote later in the week on cutting taxes for businesses. Also, as Congress returns from a two-week break, lawmakers will hold hearings on lavish spending by the General Services Administration. Today, California Republican Daryl Issa was asked about that and about the 11 Secret Service agents accused of seeing prostitutes in Colombia ahead of President Obama's summit there this past weekend. Issa said both issues needed to be accounted for. Michael Shear covers politics for the New York Times. Michael, start with the tax votes. Largely symbolic?
Yeah, largely symbolic, but interesting because I think it really highlights in both cases, on Republican and Democratic sides, the really big narratives that they're both trying to push as the week goes on.
And as people are staring at their tax returns, perhaps, you know, just trying to get them in. Well, there's an interesting story in today's Wall Street Journal. A reporter standing out on a sidewalk while Mitt Romney was giving a speech inside somewhere, overheard Romney giving details about what tax deductions Romney would eliminate to pay for the income tax cut he's proposed. And he told the crowd that he'd cut or limit the mortgage interest deduction for second homes and a few other deductions for high earners. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting. It was one of those moments that you always hope for as a reporter where, you know, the candidate is a little bit more revealing in private than they are in public. And I'm not sure there were any huge surprises in there. I mean, he's talked about limiting deductions for wealthier folks in the past, but I think it's a telling, it's a little bit more meat on the bones.
Well, and I was also going to say, I put it the way he probably would want me to put it, but it could be seen by some of his core backers as he says he'd raise taxes.
Obviously they wouldn't put it that way, but part of what is going to happen over the course of the next several months is that the Romney campaign is going to shift its focus to talking to a more kind of centrist swing voter population. And for those folks, you know, maybe less so than the primary voters that he's been talking to for the past several months, for those folks, the idea of a little bit of a more of a focus on the middle class and less of a focus on lowering taxes for the wealthy is probably a good thing. It'll probably earn him some votes.
Yeah. Mitt Romney and Ann Romney will sit down with ABC's Diane Sawyer today for their first joint interview. And assuredly, the comments from Democratic consultant Hillary Rosen about Ann Romney not working are still reverberating. Interesting column from Joan Vernocchi in the Boston Globe over the weekend. She found a comment from Mitt Romney when he was running for Senate years ago, saying that he tells his children that their life, the fact that they have a stay-at-home mom, the fact that, you know, they can live the way they live, doesn't resemble other lives, that they've won the lottery. So he seemed back then to be saying that they don't reflect most American lives. People are saying that this dust-up over women has already blown away over the weekend. Your thoughts?
I think the specifics, the specific comments by Hillary Rosen probably blow over. They're not likely to be a subject of a, you know, intense conversation in October. But I think the broader question about who can relate to the plight of the middle class, and particularly who can relate to a constituency that both campaigns are going to fight over hard, which is, you know, suburban women and middle class women, that question is going to loom large. And if this feeds kind of a perception on one side of the other that either President Obama or Mr. Romney are better or worse at relating to that core constituency, that could be an important thing several months from now.
Help us look quickly at the GSA scandal. As we said, hearings today, three of them. We know the head of the General Services Administration, which, by the way, is the agency charged with overseeing federal real estate and government purchasing. The head of that agency resigned. Several employees have been fired or placed on leave after reports of this 2010 conference, thousands of dollars spent on pre-planning conferences, things like mind readers, $7 sushi rolls. I mean, just, you know, we've heard about the excess. How's this going to play out politically?
Well, here's what I think is important about both that incident as well as the Secret Service agents is that, as we said at the beginning, there are big narratives that both campaigns want to tell about themselves and about their opponents. These kinds of little mini scandals interrupt the narrative building process. It makes it harder for both sides to kind of establish a storyline that voters can follow. And both of these, the GSA scandal and the Secret Service agents, are probably momentary in the sense that they're not big enough to kind of create months-long scandals. But to the extent that there are hearings, to the extent that there are stories that appear, it causes the president's team in Chicago a lot of heartburn because they can't. It interrupts the flow, and they can't sort of build the kind of story they want to build about their opponent and about themselves.
Michael Scheer, chief political writer for the Caucus, the political blog of the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Happy to do it.
Well, earlier this month, the Wall Street Journal advised investors who put money in factories in China to consider another country with a growing manufacturing sector, skilled workers, cheap and abundant energy, stable institutions, and a middle class that loves to buy things. That country, of course, being the U.S. We've talked about this. In March, manufacturing jobs grew for the 32nd straight month. And from the State House to the White House, U.S. factories are being pelted with tax breaks and incentives to grow more jobs. But our next guest says don't put all your recovery eggs in the manufacturing basket. He says there are now always going to be fewer workers making more things in the U.S. And that's a good thing because remember what happened to the oblong tomato. Let's explain. Eduardo Porto writes the Economic Sense column for the New York Times. Eduardo, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm fine. Thanks for being here. And it seems like the key to your article I find here in a paragraph about six or seven down. You say that while people think that, oh my gosh, we're not making anything anymore, there was the Great Recession, there was China, there's outsourcing, that actually real value added in manufacturing, you know, the types of stuff made, has grown more than two-thirds since 1979, when manufacturing employed maybe 8 million more people than it did today.
Yep, that was, in fact, the peak of manufacturing employment, 1979, and since then it's been falling. You know, manufacturing has become a very, very productive industry, so it makes more stuff with fewer workers.
Well, and you say the cautionary tale that could have flagged this for us involves the oblong tomato. What is it about the oblong tomato? What's the story?
The background is when people talk about the loss of jobs in manufacturing, one immediately thinks of agriculture. You know, in this country, I don't know, 100, 200 years ago, most of the population worked in agriculture. And as agriculture became more and more and more productive, it required fewer and fewer and fewer workers. And so right now, only a tiny percent of the workforce works in agriculture. And the little story that I used was something actually quite recent in the 1960s, when the scientists at the University of California, Davis, developed this tomato that was oblong and could easily be cut with a machine. You didn't really need the hands of a farm worker to harvest them. You could harvest them automatically quite well. All the tomatoes ripened at the same time, and they had the right shape to be cut with a machine.
It sounds a little Franken-tomato, but, you know, this was heralded because if all the tomatoes could ripen at the same time and be the same shape, then all you had to do was create a machine, which they did, that could then just go down and the machine could pick them all.
Well, that's right. And suddenly there was no need for tomato harvesters anymore. And the number of workers hired for the tomato harvest fell by like 90% in a matter of just a few years. And so the California Rural Legal Assistance, which was a worker advocacy group, they sued the university for developing a technology that was basically reducing work. And the Carter administration at the time reacted in the same way. And you had the agriculture secretary, Bob Berglund, he declared that the government would not finance any more projects that were aimed at replacing workers with machines. So funding for mechanization of the harvest dried up entirely. Then agriculture turned entirely to illegal immigrants. It was either machines or illegal immigrants. I went to do this piece in Florida in the early 2000s. They were bringing machines to try to knock the oranges off the trees. And they had illegal immigrants there. But I was thinking, this isn't really pretty cheap labor. And they said, yeah, but it's not cheap enough. They were competing against Brazil, and oranges from Brazil were much cheaper even than using illegal immigrants here. So they were trying to bring machines back in. Very interesting.
So machines are coming back in agriculture, but when they were banned, because as you say, they replaced jobs, you say that created the lowest paid, most grueling jobs in America, as opposed to manufacturing, where there may be fewer jobs, but in fact, they're better jobs. So
that's true. That's exactly right. I mean, there are fewer jobs. They require more education, more training, but they are better paid. They are better jobs. In fact, lots of the jobs that we've lost to places like China and Vietnam are jobs where you have somebody polishing by hand the screen of an iPhone for, you know, a couple of dollars a day. Is a job that no longer exists in the United States. Here we need jobs that pay more.
We talked to economist Dan Gross, who says the same thing. He says, we're not going to make transistor radios anymore. We're just not going to pay people to do that grueling work when China has sort of taken over that. But we will make big stuff like Boeing airplanes, and our workers will be more educated to do that work.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that, you know, I don't expect manufacturing to generate tons of new jobs doesn't mean that I don't think there's a great future for manufacturing, but that's not where a lot of jobs are going to come from. And here's the other thought. I mean, most of the jobs in this country are created in the non-tradable sectors, the sectors that are not exposed to international competition. The sectors that are exposed to international competition, like manufacturing, have to be really on their toes to cut costs, to make the best possible product at the lowest possible cost. And so they are super productive. They are very high tech, and they employ fewer people.
Well, you cite other researchers, Nobel laureate Mike Spence at New York University, who found that the part of the economy that doesn't have foreign competition, in other words, you're not going to send your child to a foreign company to be babysat. You know, somebody here will babysit them. Those parts of the economy added 27.3 million jobs from 1990 to 2008.
Yeah. And by contrast, is that the sector that competes in global markets added zero in that period.
Yeah. Well, but let me ask you a couple of things.
Yeah.
You also, and you just, you know, wide-ranging look at all of this, you quote the fascinating economist Enrico Moretti, who found that the average American factory worker makes $180,000 worth of goods a year. That's more than three times what that factory worker produced in 1978 in today's dollars. And that underscores what you've been saying, that there are fewer workers producing more. Shouldn't one of the takeaways from that be, you know, why haven't the wages gone up?
Well, I mean, that is a really depressing dynamic. And it has a lot to do with international competition. Suddenly there's a pool of workers that have come on stream into this sort of like the global marketplace, and I'm thinking of China here, that were not in the global marketplace, you know, 20 years ago. I think also the increased reliance on capital investment, on technology, you know, that's part of the productivity story, has also shifted money away from workers, because the workers are not just, again, competing with Chinese, they're competing against machines. And so I think that's part of the story, but it is a depressing tale.
Welcome back to our conversation with New York Times columnist Eduardo Porter about manufacturing jobs. He says there are going to be fewer in the future, and that's a good thing because they'll be higher paying and use more technology, as opposed to farming, which resisted mechanization in the 70s and had more jobs, but they were low paid, dangerous, and attracted illegal immigrants. Eduardo says since there are never going to be as many manufacturing jobs as before, investment should be made in innovative industries like Apple, industries that boost non-tradable sectors, in other words, jobs like waiters and nannies, jobs that can't be sent overseas. But Eduardo, factories are doing well, and you say there are other factors. Chinese wages are going up. The Chinese government is letting its currency gain against the U.S. dollar. The price of oil is making a lot of manufacturing companies bring jobs home. Milwaukee's Masterlock is one of them.
Well, you know, that company is a very old company. It's been around since the 20s. You know, it makes most of the locks that you see in locker rooms around the country are made by them. They had a very famous ad in a Super Bowl in the 1970s where somebody shot one of their locks and the bullet went through, but the lock didn't open. They moved a lot of work overseas to China. They also have a plant in Nogales in Mexico. And a year or two ago, they started moving some jobs back because of these pressures that you were referring to a moment ago, you know, rising wages in China, the rising cost of transportation and so forth. It's not a ton of new jobs. I don't know, about 100 in the last year and a half. But, you know, it's a nice trend. General Electric has brought back some jobs making appliances to a plant in Kentucky. Car companies, the big three, have in their last union contract, they included promises to insource, to resource into the United States jobs of making cars that were being made now in Mexico and Europe. So this is a real trend. I just don't know how big it's going to be at the end of the day, but it certainly is real.
Well, it's real, but as you said, no matter how big it is, it's never going to be as big as it was before, jobs-wise, because of the technology. I mean, you
That's
speak
right.
to the United Auto Workers, Ron McEnroy, who represents workers at Master Lock, and he said it's because the company is using a combination of manpower and these machines that they can be successful. So it's never going to be as many jobs because there's going to be more technology, which brings us back to don't forget the innovative industries, companies like Apple. You know, the complaint about Apple is they do so much of their work overseas, but you say what?
Well, helping manufacturing, you know, is fine, but I think that the focus should be not narrowly on manufacturing, but more on what this country does very well and is very competitive at, and I think that you could call that the innovation industries. And in fact, this is not my term. This is Enrico Moretti's term. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. Mm-hmm. He looks at, you know, the geography of employment across the United States, and he makes this point that the more dynamic industry in the United States, the more competitive industry that generates the most, you know, value added, the most wealth, is the innovation industry. And this does include, you know, companies like Apple, which is a manufacturer, but it also includes companies like the people who make the apps that run on an iPhone or an iPad. That's not a manufacturing industry. That's a service industry.
Give us Moretti's comparison. I mean, what's the jobs added when you build a factory or you have manufacturing
okay,
versus...
Okay, well, here's the cool comparison. I mean, we were talking a moment ago that most of the jobs created in these countries are in non-tradable sectors, right? And so we can look at how many jobs in these non-tradable sectors are generated for each manufacturing job or for each job in innovation industries. And Mr. Moretti finds that for each job in an innovation industry, you create five other local jobs. You know, a doctor, a lawyer, a waiter, you know, a hairdresser. But so for every one job in an innovation industry, you get five local jobs. By contrast, for every manufacturing job, you create about 1.6 local jobs in the non-tradable industry. So the multiplier effect of, say, of innovation industries broadly understood is much, much bigger. That's partly because in innovation industries, wages are fairly high. You know, the average Microsoft employee earns about $170,000 a year. This is another calculation that Mr. Moretti does, is he figures that with that wage, each Microsoft employee can support two jobs at $40,000 a year in the Seattle area.
You know, this idea that, you know, be more open to supporting something other than just manufacturing. Christina Romer, President Obama's former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, you know, she recently wrote an op-ed piece in your paper asking, do manufacturers need special treatment? She said no.
That's right. I mean, and her thinking is, why are we so obsessed with stuff? As if, you know, the only thing that carried value was stuff. But in fact, most of what we make, quote, as an economy is not stuff. It's services. To give you an example, right now, Americans spend about a third of their personal consumer spending, about a third of that goes to things, goods. In 1970, it was about 50%. And so this obsession with stuff is not necessarily the best guide of policy.
Enrico Moretti also says that where you live, because of what you just explained, because these innovative industries like Apple, let's say, produce so much more jobs and salaries, your geography determines your success in life. So we'll take a separate look at that. But meanwhile, I guess I'm just wondering, as the world moves from one that the economy is more based on agriculture to one that's based on manufacturing to one that's leaning more towards innovation, maybe the manufacturing sector needs the support precisely because it's whole swaths of the country that need some support. I mean, until Silicon Valley is built in Nebraska, manufacturing in Nebraska might need support.
Let's think about that for a second. If you want a competitive manufacturing industry, you're going to have to accept that it is probably going to employ fewer people. It's going to be a more high-tech operation. If what you want is to have lots and lots of jobs in manufacturing, and you want that manufacturing company to be competitive with manufacturing companies in China and other countries in the world, you're probably going to have to pay a wage that people in Nebraska aren't going to want.
Right. You're going to have illegal immigrant farm workers.
But that's very, that,
yeah.
You said it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Eduardo Porter, he writes the Economic Sense column for the New York Times, also author of the book The Price of Everything. For more on both, go to herenow.org. Eduardo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai is blaming Sunday's coordinated attacks in his country on NATO intelligence failures. The Taliban is claiming credit, but Afghan officials and U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker say the Pakistan-based Haqqani network was behind the attacks. At least 51 died, including civilians. British and German embassies were among the targets in the capital, Kabul, but there are also coordinated attacks in three provinces. Let's find out more. Douglas Wissing is a freelance journalist who's covered the war in Afghanistan extensively. His new book is Funding the Enemy: How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. And Douglas, the Taliban is claiming credit, but what do you make of these reports, including from Ambassador Crocker, that they couldn't have done this by themselves, that the Haqqani network helped? Your thoughts?
Well, you know, the Haqqani network is another group of fundamentalist Islamic fighters that are in eastern Afghanistan, primarily is where their area of operation. And they do a number of these operations in Kabul. They do cooperate with the Taliban, and it's somewhat of a porous barrier between them. I don't exactly understand why we're wanting to parse that difference quite so much, because the term that's often used nowadays is neo-Taliban. It's groups like the Haqqani network and the Taliban that are working together in various ways.
Well, one reason people might want to parse it is because of the Pakistan connection. Now, the Haqqani network has in the past been described as a family clan, a criminal network, but also by former Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair Mike Mullen as a veritable arm of the Pakistani intelligence agency. You know, are you saying maybe the Taliban is also as connected to Pakistan?
I think the links between Pakistan and the Taliban are pretty well known.
Yeah.
And the Haqqani network, you know, the ISI has always been playing both sides of the game on this.
Well, what does it say to you that these attacks occurred largely in Kabul, the heart of the city, where the parliament building is located, along with, as we mentioned, the embassies? NATO headquarters was also attacked. Your sense of what that says about the insurgency?
Well, it's saying, one, that they're sending a very clear message to us that they're able to penetrate at will where they want to go. And, you know, we have trumpeted that Kabul is surrounded by a ring of steel, that the Afghan national security forces are so strong that they're going to be able to take care of maintaining security in the capital. And this has proven once again that the insurgents have penetrated deep into the heart of the Ring of Steel. As with much of U.S.-funded development in Afghanistan, the Ring of Steel is proving to be substandard and pretty brittle.
Yeah. Well, as we heard, President Karzai blamed these attacks on intelligence failures on the part of NATO. He praised Afghan security forces, as did NATO Commander General John Allen. Is that about saving face? I mean, you know, what do you think we should take from that?
Well, President Karzai is, of course, going to talk positively about his forces, and is, of course, going to blame NATO for intelligence failures, and how much of the NATO intelligence failure is apt, I can't really judge.
Yeah. Yeah.
NATO has had trouble penetrating into Afghan society, and, you know, that's been pretty well documented.
And just very briefly, just got a minute here. I can't help but ask, we're going to have you back, but your new book, Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. Again, just give me the headline. How do U.S. taxpayers bankroll the Taliban?
Well, when I was out in eastern Afghanistan, Robin, as we talked about a little while ago, the soldiers began telling me there was a toxic system that was connecting distracted American officials, private U.S. corporations, corrupt Afghan insiders, and the Taliban. We're funding our own enemy, they tell me. We're financing both sides of the war.
Well,
and that's the case, for instance, the Haqqani network is financing themselves primarily by skimming our contracts.
Well, and you, as we mentioned, you were in Afghanistan because you were embedded with a National Guard unit from Indiana that was teaching Afghans how to farm. And that was a fascinating conversation. We'll link people to it hereandnow.org. But we'll have you back to talk more about what you found when you traveled with that Indiana National Guard unit. Doug, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And now, a story of a dream gone terribly wrong. In the 1960s, Elliot and Sue Coleman were two idealistic hippies from relatively well-to-do families who packed all their possessions into a pickup and moved to Maine to become disciples of Helen and Scott Nearing, whose book, Living the Good Life, was the Bible of the Back to the Land movement. Elliot and Sue also built a house with their own hands, lived without electricity or running water, as their daughter Melissa recounts.
My parents lived the good life, as defined by the Nearings, striving to follow the Nearing formula of 4 hours a day of bread labor, 4 hours of intellectual pursuits, and 4 hours of social time. In other words, divide the day between hands, head, and heart. Hands, chopping wood, making food, woodworking, sewing. Head, reading, learning to play the dulcimer. Heart, caring for each other. Talking and laughing together.
Melissa Coleman was born in 1968, followed 4 years later by Heidi. They'd run naked through the Maine woods with the often equally naked young men and women eager to become apprentices in this vanguard organic food movement. Even the Wall Street Journal came to write about them. But within years, Melissa's dad's overactive thyroid made him manic. Her overworked mother slipped into depression. It seems to us that the lifestyle didn't cause little Heidi's death by drowning in the pond, but she became a sad symbol of this paradise lost. Melissa Coleman tells the story in her book, This Life is in Your Hands, One Dream, 60 Acres, and a Family's Heartbreak. It recently was released in paperback. We spoke to Melissa when the book first came out and asked, did she agree? Was it lifestyle that caused Heidi's death, or was this something tragic that could have happened in a backyard suburban pool?
Well, I believe that the second is more likely. Yeah. You know, for me, this was just a really wonderful childhood in so many ways. And I'm very glad that I was able to experience what I did experience, and my family as well.
For your mom, it was hard work because she's not only bearing children and, you know, full-time mom, but seaweed needs to be hauled up from the ocean to cover the garden beds and provide potassium. Carrots and beets have to be put in sand in the root cellars, winter squash seasoning on the patio. Your dad's building a greenhouse, chopping wood. This is hard.
Yes, it was amazingly hard. They were up for the challenge, though. They felt that at that time that was the best way to channel their energies.
Yeah, but it obviously soon became exhausting. And also, what had been freeing seemed to become rigid.
Yes, I think originally they were seeking to be free. And then soon they realized they didn't have any time to do those things they were imagining doing with their freedom.
Also, they had made such a vow to themselves and had so disdained what was happening in the outside world, some of it pretty disdainful. You know, we were seeing the beginning of factory farming and chemicals in foods. They were, your father in particular, was ahead of his time.
Yeah, I think of it as a pendulum. You know, it had to swing way far over to make a difference, to make a change.
And then there's the fame.
Right. My face was the picture on the cover of the Wall Street Journal in 1971. I guess it was one of the most written in about articles that year.
The article was about how your mom and dad had rejected, you know, their parents' lifestyles and moved up to this hippie commune with the Nearings. But your dad was also really making points about organic food in particular.
People thought this sounded great. There was also the encroaching energy crisis. And people wanted to try to kind of step outside of what they saw as troublesome times and do it themselves.
Yeah. Right. Well, and your family was living on $2,000 a year, but now there's this influx. There's these young people who want to throw off the shackles and, by the way, most of their clothing and come up to the compound. And there's the tourists who want to come and buy this good organic food using, you know, really some relatively new thinking at the time. That was good in a way, but it was more pressure, particularly on your mom.
Right. You know, as there were more and more people at the farm, it was more and more people to take care of in a way. They were like more children. And my mother was having a hard enough time, I think, with her own children. She loved the apprentices. She liked them a lot. But she needed privacy in her days to sort of regain her composure.
Yeah. Well, and then, of course, comes the day that, you know, Heidi, she's 3 years old, is found face down in the pond. And you know, there's not any horrible neglect. A lot of families can't survive that. Yours didn't. Was part of this book to, I don't know, commune with her? How does her death fit into this story of this unraveling utopia?
When I had kids of my own, I started to think a lot about my little sister and worry. You know, if we couldn't save my sister, I worried, how could I be sure I could save my own children? And so I had to write about it to understand what happened. And in the process, I got an unexpected gift, and that was that I realized, okay, maybe I couldn't have saved my sister, but I can bring her back to life on these pages.
And what about the other characters? Your dad went on to become a renowned leader in the organic food movement. Your mom went on a lot of journeys before she seemed to find peace. The Nearings passed. They were ancient then. And now there's sort of a center devoted to them on the spot where this all happened that, by the way, has electricity and all the things that you lived without, you know.
Right.
How have those people responded to the story?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I was writing the book, I was just trying to get the story. I was like a mystery. I was trying to solve what happened. I had to track people down, do research. And then when the book came out, though, I had this just feeling of like, oh, my gosh, what have I done? You know, I've put this out into the world, and I don't know how it's going to be. You know, I don't know if they're going to like it. My parents, how are they going to feel about it?
So how did they respond?
They have responded by just being amazingly generous about it. I think it's been really hard for them, but they understood that I needed to tell my story, and they gave me the freedom to do that.
And I'm just wondering, have you heard from any other kids who are sort of children of the flower children of the late 60s, early 70s?
Yes, that's been a great part about this. People say, oh, that's really how it was like. And then to hear from some of the other apprentices that show up at readings and bring pictures just to reconnect with a time that it will never be quite like that again.
For its wonderfulness and its flaws.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And hopefully we can learn from history and try to today be more balanced about our choices. You know, you can have an organic garden without living without electricity. There's lots of middle grounds, I think, today that are available to us.
That's Melissa Coleman. We spoke last May. Her book, This Life is in Your Hands, One Dream, 60 Acres, and a Family's Heartbreak, has just been released in paperback. The big story at today's 116th Boston Marathon, heat, temperatures in the 80s. Here now is Alex Ashlock is at the finish line. Alex, defending men's champ Jeffrey Mutai dropped out at the 18-mile mark. He was cramping. We can't say for sure if it was heat, but what a disappointment.
Yeah, this a big disappointment for him. He was hoping to run a fast race today to make the Kenyan Olympic team. I would guess that he cramped up because of the heat, because I'm hearing that a larger number than usual of the elite athletes in the field today dropped out. I can't give you the exact number, but it was more than usual. So the heat is definitely taking a toll.
Well, before we go further, reel off the winners.
Kenya sweeps in both the men's and women's race. Races today, Wesley Correa and Levi Matibo of Kenya were first and second in the men's race. The time for Correa, 2 hours, 12 minutes, and 40 seconds. That's more than 9 minutes faster than Jeffrey Mutai's winning time last year. Oh, 9 minutes slower, I should say, than Jeffrey Mutai's time last year. Sharon Sharoff won the women's race in 2 hours, 31 minutes, and 50 seconds. Again, many, many minutes slower than the women's winning time last year. But again, a close women's finish. In fact, the fifth straight year the women's race has been decided by 3 seconds or less. A world record in the men's wheelchair race, Joshua Cassidy of Canada winning that race, and an American, Shirley Riley, took the women's wheelchair race.
Well, we just have a couple seconds. The officials took the unprecedented step of saying people could hold on to their numbers if they didn't run today because of the heat and they could use them next year. Do you know how many took them up on it?
You know, I don't have that number, but I can tell you that some 3,800 runners who were entered in the race, they didn't even bother to pick up their numbers.
Right.
So that's many hundreds more than normally don't show up to pick up their numbers. So that the heat must have had an impact on them as well.
Well, it might have been a good thing. Here now is Alex Ashlock at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Thanks as always.
You're welcome, Robin.
And we continue with a little more of Alex on Alberto Salazar. Salazar grew up in a demanding family. His Cuban father was a close ally of Fidel Castro. He became so disillusioned with the Cuban leader he trained for but didn't participate in the failed U.S. attempt to oust Castro, the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. Eventually, Alberto Salazar's family settled in Wayland, Massachusetts, where the young Alberto turned to running, a brief but brilliant marathon career. Between 1980 and 1984, he won three straight New York City marathons. Boston once, he set a world record, competed in the Olympic marathon. But then it was over. Alberto Salazar suffered a series of health problems, severe depression, and finally in 2007, a heart attack that left him technically dead for 14 minutes. Hence the title of a new book written by John Brandt. It's called 14 Minutes, A Running Legend's Life and Death and Life. And Alberto Salazar recently spoke with our marathon man, Alex Ashlock.
You write about this in the book. You had a confidence that was interpreted by some as arrogance as an athlete, as a runner. Where did that confidence come from?
I think that the confidence I had came from my training. And at the age of 16, I started training with the Greater Boston Track Club, with Bill Squires, who was the coach, and with Bill Rogers, who was about to break through with his first major marathon win. And so I was pretty knowledgeable about the sport. As a young kid, as a rookie with the Greater Boston Track Club, which was my nickname, I was training with a lot of the best marathoners in the world. And so by the time I was 23 or 24, I had already figured out what workouts meant and what workouts would predict certain performances. And I had gotten to a level where I pretty well knew my own body and what I was capable of. And so my confidence wasn't something where I could ever predict or knew that I was going to beat any particular person. You never know what that person is going to do or what they're capable of. But I was always pretty confident about what I was capable of doing. And so to me, it was never a stretch to say, well, I think I'm in shape to run 208 or 209, and that's faster than anybody else here, so I've got a good chance of winning. But, yeah, it was just a confidence in myself. I don't think it was an arrogance, really, that that I was necessarily better than everybody else.
It's interesting because you say in the book that you thought you were the toughest runner in most every race you participated in.
Yeah, I did have a confidence that I was training harder than anybody else. And the running community is pretty close-knit, and you always kind of know what other people are doing and people talk and so forth. And so I knew that the way I was training was harder than anyone else. And so that kind of gave me a confidence that mentally I felt I'd put myself through harder work and more pain than any of my competitors. And so, you know, whether it makes any sense or not, in my mind, it was like I deserve to win more than them because I've suffered more. And there was the confidence that when I was out there suffering with my competitors, I felt like I was better prepared, that I had gone through more pain and that I could handle it, and that no matter how bad it was, since I felt that I was tougher and I had trained harder, that they must be hurting more. So that was what sort of gave me solace and made me feel like I just had to hang on, and sooner or later they would break.
Did some of your drive come from your family, your relationship with your father?
I think a lot of my drive and personality, good and bad, came from my family. And I think that's probably the same for a lot of us. You know, that's where we learn. And certainly from my father, you know, I definitely learned the value of hard work. And from him, I learned that you had to give everything you had, and that if you didn't give everything that you had, you're kind of a failure. And so it was something from a young kid on that I always felt that I had to do the best that I could at everything that I did. Otherwise, I wouldn't live up not only to his expectations, but what he had put into my mind should be my expectations for myself.
The hinge of your book is your heart attack in 2007 when you were technically dead, I think, for 14 minutes. Obviously, the title of the book. But when you were a kid, I think your brother almost killed you with a bow and arrow. You had the 1978 Falmouth Road Race, where I think your body temperature went up to something like 108. The 1982 Boston Marathon, you and Dick Beardsley just about ran each other to death. Do you think all of that prepared you for this heart attack that you have that you survived?
Yeah, I had a lot of near-death experiences. In fact, more than we even put in the book, because we felt at some point it was
kind of hard to believe.
Pardon the pun, overkill. But literally, yeah, I'm lucky to still be alive. I wonder if I'm really a cat, and I've almost used up my nine lives. But I think that I had a lot of close brushes, and I just think of our lifestyle and where we came from, Cuba. I mean, we were a bit different and a little wild, but I don't really think that all those brushes necessarily prepared me for my final heart attack. I think that the reason I survived my heart attack, or as I say in the book, I think one, physically, that I was in tremendous shape. So even though I had some clogged arteries, I was able to not. My heart was able to resume beating after 14 minutes, which most hearts won't. And then number two, as I talk about in the book, I just think that it wasn't my time to go, that it wasn't God's plan for me, and that he was going to give me one more shot at life.
Yeah, you really attribute a lot of that to a lot of what's happened to you, to your faith.
Well, absolutely. I do have tremendous faith in God, and I don't, at the same time, I don't think of myself as a particularly...
You're not wearing it on your sleeve, basically.
Yeah, I don't think myself as being especially religious or holy or good or anything of those things. But I do believe that, I have a faith in God, that he has a plan for me. I think he has a plan for all of us, and he doesn't expect us to be perfect. He just wants us to try to do the best that we can with our lives.